we absolutely knew that Donald Trump, as president number 47 of the United States, was going to be a bumpy ride. And he comes in hot with all sorts of executive orders, which for South Africans have been also quite interesting to watch over the past couple of weeks, as he has completely trained his eye on South Africa. Quite a number of executive orders in the middle of the night. He started out with a worldwide cut, 90-day cut of U.S. aid and other assistance for around the world, and then came back with very specific cutting to South Africa, he says. Aid of any kind, particularly because of the Expropriation Without Compensation Act, which has now been signed by our President Cyril Ramaphosa, which has got everybody up in arms. Over the past week, if you are under a rock, you will not have seen any of this. South Africans, every forum, scrambling, all sorts of people on all the social media platforms saying all sorts of things. And it is quite a polarizing conversation to have. So I thought, let's take a look at everything else around this thing, take a little bit of the heat out of this conversation. And South Africa being a country with one of the highest number of NGOs or public benefit organizations operating in it on the continent, we have over 280,000 public benefit organizations that were registered by the end of September in 2023. I asked a friend of mine, they call him Kofi Zulu, but he is actually Kofi Kwaku, who is a senior lecturer at the Wits School of Governance. He is also a researcher and analyst at the Center for Africa-China Studies at UJ, has over 25 years experience in the communications, strategic communications of governance and engagement, public engagement and strategic engagement. And so who better to talk to than a South African who's a South African, an African, and a man about the world who has all of this experience and also in various guises has been a lecturer, a teacher, a strategic advisor to governments and NGOs around the world. Mr. Kofi, thank you for coming to Level Up.
Thank you very much. Us. Thanks for your kind words. I don't know if I'm going to live up to that, but thank you very much.
Oh, I'm sure you will. So, I want you to treat this conversation a little bit like a 101 lecture. I think there are so many things happening around all of these things that we are talking about, but some of the fundamentals and the basics, a lot of us don't really have, and you can't encapsulate them in a 145-character tweet, as it were. So let's start with the executive orders. We see so many being signed by Donald Trump. What is the executive order allow Donald Trump to get away with, and how is it different from how normally Congress and the Senate and the presidency work with each other in the States? So tell me a little bit about that, and then we'll start unpacking what those executive orders mean for South Africa in particular.
Yes. So good morning to your audience and everybody else, and I'm glad you've invited me. I hope I'll be able to contribute well enough. But at the heart of this whole thing, it's about power and authority. Now, in any government around the world, and of course the United States has a really good image in terms of freedom, democracy, all the other things that you know about, but the reality has changed. However, it's about power. How do you govern? And to be able to govern, the democratic system allows the people to vote, to sort of, if you want, outsource their power to specific people. They said, okay, we want you to run us in one way or another. And that democracy and the idea of democracy has two things. The idea itself that people, they usually summarize it this way, it's by the people for the people, right, in large part. However, we can see that as much as it's for the people by the people, they still outsource it to somebody else to do it, a form of government. But in the U.S., it's been quite a very interesting thing because in the 17th and 18th century, people wanted to sort of get a little bit away from, you know, royal decree from the U.K., basically from England, because England was an empire. So they fought very hard. They were monarchists. People wanted to stay with the king or the queen, whatever it is. And others wanted to be independent. And much of the United States was put together by competing powers in Europe, especially France. They had a huge swath of land in the Americas. I mean, you could hear things like Louisiana. Even some of the names are still French. You can hear the French sounds. And part of these territories were sold to the quote-unquote who became Americans today. So these kind of powers force people to figure out what kind of system do we need to govern ourselves away from the empire of the British. And then they naturally came. They had 13 states, and then with time they moved to 50. But the idea was to build a Republican idea, which means be free enough. So they put out the Constitution, and then they thought about a federal system, which meant you have a federal government, and the states that are part of it have their own rules and laws.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. But what does that mean for us is that, for our conversation, is that you have a president. You have somebody who's going to represent them. And this person is sitting in something called, incidentally, the White House, not the Black House, but the White House. You know, it's got, the reason I'm saying this, it's got some metaphorically meaning as well. And this person is elected, and in the old days, it was elected for a while, the first president, George Washington, and then so on and so on until we get 45, which is basically the man we're talking about, Trump. And then he took a break. And he came back.
So number people, 45 and 47.
Exactly. People are thinking in terms of there's a lot of messianic talks. And I mean, it's just unbelievable, the conspiracies that we hear about this 45 and 47. Sometimes people are trying to even figure out what is the dash in between mean and all kinds of weird stuff. But at the heart of it, the authorities that are vested into the President of the United States and President Trump is what's called the Article 2 of the Constitution of the United States. Mm. The Constitution is a body of laws that help this country become what it is. Of course, you have the executive, the judicial, and then the legislative. Uh-huh. You know, talk about Senate and so forth. We have almost
a very
relatively
similar
system in South Africa. But so this Article 2 gives it the mandate and the power to decide. And at the heart of it, this is really what makes it interesting, is that he could use it. That's what they call executive orders, which mean coming from that power from the Constitution said, I mandate that this and this must be done.
Mm.
So that authority is very, very important. It forces everything else. He doesn't have to go to Congress or Senate. However, the Congress and Senate can still try to challenge him. Yes, the court can also challenge it, but usually it doesn't happen for some strange reasons. So far, he signed 53 executive orders, of which one of them against South Africa, well, I wouldn't say against, but towards South Africa is part of. But this one, and the reason for signing it and saying that South Africa is mistreating white people and Afrikaners, and he's going to give that executive order or give power to the U.S. government to grant refugee status to Afrikaner whites. A little bit problematic. In fact, it hits a couple of things. I mean, I'm talking about it for personal reason. As a communicator, I think the term refugee shouldn't have been used in it. Mm-hmm. They could have used another term. And the reason is Afrikaners now, when I look around and I start to hear what they're coming up with, they seem offended to be refugees in the United States. Mm. The pride of the Afrikaner doesn't accept these kind of things easy. Mm-hmm. That's at the psychological level. Mm. At the economic level, I don't think Afrikaners who are doing so well in South Africa, by and large, will be immigrating in drove to the United States and be considered refugees. Mm. They have economic power in the country. Largely, most of them are doing quite well. And as you know, they at the conference press conference that AfriForum
and
Kali Kirila and others have said, we are going nowhere. This is a powerful set of we are going nowhere. Four words that really encapsulate everything. So here we are. But at the heart really of this, it's not about the expropriation acts. The backdrop really, and in fact, if you read the executive order, there's a couple of lines saying that South Africa has gone against the United States ally in the Middle East. Which one is it? You all know it, Israel. So the case, the ICJ genocide case against Israel, is really the driving force that really put this thing, this executive order, into play. It's not just about Hamas, as the executive order says as well, or Iran. But really the core of it is the ICJ. And it seems people are not discussing that. The focus now has become very emotional, right? So this executive order has just triggered South Africans emotionally about land, about Afrikaner, about race. So as you said at the beginning, there's now South Africans are now distracted about race issues and land issues. But the real issue is the unhappiness of the United States about the ICJ genocide case against Israel.
So, I mean, I think that there are so many moving parts to what's happening. And originally, with the executive order that put particularly USAID around the world on this 90-day stop order was the first salvo, which for an organization, USAID, having been started by JFK in 1961, such an old organization that is operating around the world, has always been part of America's foreign policy.
Soft power.
Soft power is what they were putting it out there.
That's right.
Right? First salvo being the pullback on that. Because Donald Trump says, we want to reassess how we spend the tax dollars of Americans, and we want to make sure that we're not just wasting our money with all of these people overseas. And so he puts this executive, this 90-day stop order. And the whole world suddenly is going, oof, you know, all of this money that's being pumped by America in various ways. What does it mean to how much they can sway the political landscape of the countries where they operate? In South Africa, huge backlash, right? Because suddenly people are going, oh, we've got PEPFAR that gets paid for and all of our HIV. And then it turns out it's 17% of what we spend on HIV research and clinics and healthcare. Then there was AGOA, which again is not a Donald Trump or a Joe Biden initiative, as you know, suddenly looks like it might be, oh, Donald Trump is going after all the Joe Biden stuff. It's not, right? Is also one of the things that we're kind of going, whew. And when the executive order comes through that says, actually stop all aid to South Africa because we are unhappy about the way South Africa is behaving, the way South Africa is making decisions that we don't believe in or decisions that we believe go against what we stand for and believe in, South Africans are going, who's in charge here? Talking about soft power. How much of the soft power does America really wield still? And does it matter? Or are South Africans just touchy?
I think the U.S. still has powerful soft power. By the simple decree that President Trump using the executive power to sort of stop the flow of funding to the rest of the world has sent a signal that's reverberating everywhere. People are now taking not only notice, but it has huge implications for the lives of people who were beneficiaries or supposedly beneficiaries. Yes? The U.S. still has that sort of power. Very powerful. There are two types of powers, according to great analysts of great powers. The first one is called hard power. largely it's about war.
We'll send our military.
A military, you force people, you invade their country, you take over, and you tell them what to do. The other one, soft power, which is really something that's almost intangible at times. It comes in the forms of money, but also culture. You know, U.S. music, for example, U.S. cinema, Hollywood, is a form of soft power for the United States. And we know that by watching their movies all the time, we become like them. We adopt them much easier. And other countries have understood that. For example, China. China's cinema, their movie business, is now supposed to be one of the biggest by 2027 or 2030, biggest than that of the United States and India. So it's just unbelievable. So using that soft power to change, to influence, to educate, to inform, to also coerce and also manipulate, propagandize the mind of other people and how you want them to behave with you. Either, and most of the time if you believe in what's called the zero-sum approach to relationship, that means there's a form of hierarchy of power. You are here and they're below you, right? And so China is trying to change that and say, we don't believe in hegemonic relations. We want what they usually call win-win approach. And very few people love that because it puts them into a very sort of equal position. A lot of countries don't like to be equal. If you were to ask France to be equal to South Africa, they'll say, no, we're not interested in that. Same as the United States. And the United States has benefited from this position since the war, at least World War II, yeah, all around the world. The U.S. is so powerful by using soft power, movies, but also using USAID money. As you said, established in 1961 by President Kennedy. The ideal, there's a difference between the ideal and the idea, right? The ideal is that the U.S. will remain the top position in the world, what they usually call the shining light on the hill, that nobody else is. They're the only one, right? But as the world starts to change, other people also want to be on that hill. So there's now some kind of competition between those who are now rising powers and then those who are already there, at least the ones we know so far as the United States. So the U.S. is using all these tools that it's got to be able to maintain itself. And USAID, USAID, as they say, is part of them. Many of us have worked for USAID in terms of product, doing stuff. So the ideal is also good. The idea was also very good. But over time, as we've seen last week, and Elon Musk and his team of people are exposing, it seems, although there's some wrong things that they have exposed in the sense of they're not telling the truth about everything. But in general, USAID ideal been hijacked for other things. I mean, the list goes on. You can find that on the internet. But for South Africa, coming back to South Africa, they're not happy with South Africa because they want South Africa to become and to stay in that same lane. The U.S. is a big power. You're going to follow what we tell you. And in fact, I'm going to say something that could be a little bit disturbing. They seem to have agents in the country, which means, you know, in intelligence language, they call assets, people they activate, who doesn't matter whatever it is, they'll toe that line and say the same thing. In fact, South Africans were benefiting from that, getting paid for it. And that's going to go on and on. So over 200 and so and so thousand NGOs, yes, that they're funding, this is a powerful, large force. So stopping it create a disturbance that they haven't seen before. So there's chaos now in this community. A good chunk of some of the work they're doing was really saving lives, I must say. But other things are not quite clear. And should I say this or not? No, I won't say that. But
oh, now you have to say it. Now I have to hear it.
I mean, there are a lot of things, for example, you know, sponsoring all kinds of vaccines against, you know, and testing new product, pharmaceutical products on South African women that we know about. You know, there are court cases and so forth.
So speaking of that, you know, speaking of testing and this money that seems to go in one direction, doesn't actually go in one direction, because if you think about it, they may be out here setting up clinics, setting up pharmaceutical testing stations, but if you consider that in the long run, the US remains the beneficiary, the biggest beneficiary, because who benefits from the research? It's the pharmaceutical companies. The biggest ARV producer in the world is an American company, right? And South Africa is still a market, you know, being the second biggest market, really, with the second highest number of HIV positive people.
Yes, both a testing market and a consuming market.
Absolutely. So are we really the beneficiaries, or does it all go full circle back to America being the beneficiary?
In large part, it goes back to the United States. You know, the crumbs in the small parts, I mean, even with the large number of 200 and so NGOs, the U.S. benefit more of that, not only on soft power, but the ability to control the flow of that money to help direct a specific thing in the country. In terms of policy, sovereignty, South Africa is weak. Does South Africa fund NGOs in the U.S.? Will South Africa do the reverse in the U.S.?
Well, speaking of, does South Africa fund NGOs in the U.S.? Mm. Also, once again, Europe and the U.S., whether it is private companies or public money, are some of the biggest funders of NGOs in South Africa. China is not.
Yeah. So China is not, it's true, but China is coming slowly.
So but even if China or Russia or Iran wanted to wield this kind of soft power, they are not a player in this field.
Sure.
Is this something that as South Africans, also as a South African government, as the people of South Africa, we should be wary of?
Yes.
That maybe we don't want them.
I won't even go far as say yes. In terms of sovereignty, you need to be able, for example, in Russia, they've now have clampdowns on NGOs, especially NGO funding coming from outside. You have to register. You have to go through very grueling systems of vetting process, because they know outside funding always disrupt the way policy is going. So they do that. So this competition about influencing Africa is working for them, because if it didn't, they wouldn't do it. Now, Trump is just saying, let's stop this for 90 days. But trust me, they'll find other avenues to be able to continue that under other different names. But what is most important is the role of Africans themselves to be at the mercy of what I called a syndrome of the golden begging bowl. Let me explain. It's a Chinese story. Yeah. So there's this beggar who he goes around and he has a begging bowl, and he asks people for food, money, and everything else every day. But he doesn't realize that he has a bowl that's in gold. So the question is, people should be asking themselves, but wait a minute, where did this gold come from? There must be more somewhere else. Do I need to continue begging when I have more assets somewhere where I can find more? And this is where we are, most African countries. People are crying out because the consequence is quite clear. Oh, we're not getting this money from the U.S. People are going to die. So the fear-mongering is coming out. It's natural. Fear is also very important. But what it tells us is that Africans are not ready at all. They're not even anticipating worse to come from President Trump. President Trump's going to be rough, hard, and brutal. And he said it already in his first term. He calls Africans, I don't want to even say this, something whole, right? And so, and he's now coming with a vengeance, because he hasn't been in power for a month, and he's already signed all these executive orders. And Africa, by and large, and especially South Africa, will be a target. But this time, he's bit the wrong end of it. I think the backlash, they're now getting the backlash in Washington. They're going to regroup and figure out what's the best way to attack South Africa. One easy way to do it is to attack the rand.
What do you mean by backlash?
They've realized that now South Africans have all come together. Even the people they're supposed to help as refugees are saying, hey, we're not interested in this thing. So what do they do now? They need to figure out something. And South Africans are unhappy. Of course, the president is sending a team to Washington. I think it's Sidney Mufamadi who is leading the team. But even with that, there's perhaps even no sign that Trump is probably going to receive them. Maybe J.D. Vance will receive them, the vice president, or somebody else. This is how they treat Africans in general, because they don't think we're strong enough. We have a lot of weaknesses domestically at home, and people are using that. One of them is poverty or extreme poverty. Huge unemployment. Statistics General Risenga Maluleke was on, 702, you know, a couple of days, talking about that. Inequalities. We now moved, we're one of the highest one on the Gini coefficient, which means the measurement for inequality. I think we're about 0.67 or something. This is the highest, which means the inequality is so huge, and we know the consequences of inequalities. Now, these are the only three, but there's more, two more. Mm. Corruption and then crime. There's a lot more, but I mean, these are very easy things to pick. People are unhappy. They're looking for jobs. Young people graduate from universities. They can't find jobs. And they're just wandering around, about 70% of young people of strength. So if these people are activated and happy, they can go on a riot very easily. Normally, I shouldn't be saying this on the radio, but these are some of the weaknesses they're going to be using. And also attack the RAND, which they did many years back, which means if the RAND goes to, let's say, 30 or 50 or 100 to the U.S. dollar, this is a disaster for us. So how do you prepare for this? We do something at WITS called anticipatory governance. The ability to think through things before they even happen. Play them out. Figure out what is really the strategy you must adopt. So if anything like that happens, you are at least a bit prepared. But it doesn't seem we are. We're reacting.
Is there anybody at the wheel?
Yeah.
Is there somebody driving this bus?
The president himself, after this executive orders
the
came out.
The president, Cyril Ramaphosa.
Didn't even come out for a press conference and say, this is South African position. But I have to give credit to his spokesperson, Vincent Mangwenya. He struggled a bit, but he came out strong. But other people also coming around. I was also listening to the former Minister of International Affairs, who also did a brilliant job on 702 the other day. She gave some excellent advice on how to go about doing this. And I'm just surprised that she's not even part of the delegation going to Washington. Of course, if she's part of the delegation, she's sort of the image of the, ICJ.
Case.
Yeah, so they probably didn't want to put her in there to irritate the Trump administration. But at least she should have been part of the, you know, preparing it. And she wasn't. So even when the people go to Washington to convince Trump, they won't buy into it easily. The Israel is so angry at South Africa, they're looking for something for revenge against SA. How do you deal with that? Who is going to be there to prepare such an anticipatory strategy to figure out what are the ways to deal with that? And we're going to pay the price. But we need to be strong. That's all. So it's going to come around. NGOs, for example, cutting off, you know, this is some of the strategy. Okay, let's start small, you know. Take off this NGO thing, hit them hard on this. And then tomorrow it could be the RAND. Other parts could be business. You have about, I think, 400, a little bit 400 or so American companies.
I think
companies.
About 600.
600 now.
600 American companies.
So this is big. And I think the volume of business is going beyond what? Is
it, I think if KFC left South Africa, there'd be a riot just because of that.
There you are. So psychologically, they've got us somewhere by the skin, right? But we are so addicted to the soft power. If they shut down, let's say, Netflix, just for a week. You're going to hear people jumping up and down and whatever it is. So KFC, as you said, or what else? There are other places that can shut down. We'll still be in trouble. But we haven't thought about these. We don't have order, discipline, a sense of direction. We're so distracted by so many things.
We don't have order or discipline, you say?
Yes. We may have it somewhere, but it's not as strong as we need it. You know, now we're now being sort of distracted again and then hit hard in the DRC. We got 14 bodies that arrived yesterday or today.
I think it was yesterday.
Yeah. I mean, so psychologically, and as you know, South Africans about death and funerals, we're very soft there. And that's only 14. I'm not taking it as a small thing, but only 14.
Listen, I think just the fact that we're speaking about the 14 that died in the DRC is a shift, because we're not talking about the 26 who died last year, both some in the DRC and some right next door in Mozambique. But yes, this is the flavor of the week this week is the DRC. Mm. And so all of those things are all about the measure at which South Africa can be so distracted. So speaking of this distraction, I am a South African and I just want to get my kid to school and I just want to pay my bond.
There you are.
How does all of these machinations, all of this big power that's happening over here affect my day-to-day? Mm. And can I do anything about it? Or must I just wait to be washed away in the flood that's coming?
No, you can't be waiting. I mean, the thing is to be aware of the connection between what's happening globally and then your own life. One of them is the cost of life, inflationary movements, the cost, for example, bread. I was having a conversation with somebody. I said, you know, we should ask President Ramaphosa, what's the cost of bread today?
He doesn't know. That exercise has already been done. Everyone has asked. John Steenhuisen was asked if he knows what the price of bread was.
He didn't.
Julius Malema asked about the price of bread. It was a whole thing before the elections. Mm. It's another distraction.
Yeah. So that sense of reality on the ground for a billionaire head of state, you know, there's some kind of disconnect somewhere, somehow, psychologically, but also in reality, in economics and so forth. I was also telling somebody, and he's been in power literally for 15 years from being deputy president and now president second term. Now, we haven't had any decent economic growth for the past 15 years. And he's supposed to be a businessman, right? And if he were in the private sector, he would have been fired.
Well, the people did try and fire him, didn't they? The people did try and fire him.
Yeah.
He lost the highest margin that the ANC has ever lost.
Yeah.
And the DA helped him get back in through the back door by having a GNU.
So in clear, he should be thinking. I think there were rumors that he wanted to
resign.
Yes, but he's still on. And one of the things, I know they've been spinning this every time they come out, they said, we're having, negative growth. I mean, I've done a bit of economics. I worked for the World Bank. I did so and so. And I mean, the term by itself is just an oxymoron and a misnomer. There's not such a thing as negative growth, per se. You know, it's when people hear growth, even if it's negative, but there's a little bit of growth, you also hear the economists around saying green shoots. You know, so these are little things to get people going, but it's not sufficient enough. And if there's no economic growth in the country, those five key issues or three issues I've mentioned, you know, those three challenges, poverty, inequality, and unemployment especially, won't change. And if they don't change, we're still very weak. And for some reason, we can't get economic growth going. When he did his SONA, he promised all of us that this coming year or the next whatever years, he's putting 900 and something billion rand for infrastructure. And somebody asked him, but wait a minute, last year you said the same thing. Where is that infrastructure that came around? Now, the reason I'm talking about this is it's closely linked to this whole thing with NGOs and USAID, which means if there's no money, where else can we find this money but through an economic growth? People feeling a little bit more comfortable, their jobs, they have resources. They don't have to worry about, you know, picking, you know, handouts from the United States, frankly. And I think that dependency syndrome that we have has become so addictive that as soon as this kind of thing happens, we psychologically jump and we feel already victimized. And we shouldn't. Because this is their money. This is the taxpayers' money. If they decide they don't want to give it to us, Who are we to tell them, please give it to us? No.
It's their money.
Yes, you have to give it to us because we deserve that money. No, right? And that's where we should be now, that sense of sovereignty, discipline, order, organizing ourselves, grow the economy one way or another. And it should be possible. You know, it seems like South Africa is on a life support somehow. We can't get the economy to grow. President Xi Jinping, according to President Ramaphosa himself, was telling him at the last BRICS summit, he reminded him also at the FOCAC, the Forum on Africa-China Partnership, or I forget the C now. But in any case, President Xi Jinping has been telling President Ramaphosa, please let's do business. Do business with China. The Chinese have dropped taxes and tariffs on all the goods for all BRICS countries and in countries of the global south. Why are we not doing it? We had a little bit of growth, but not much. And why are we not exploiting this? People are asking themselves, what is so complicated? It's now finally that, in fact, we're getting a little bit of money from Chinese tourism, Chinese and Indian tourism, but it was blocked. They now opened up for Chinese tourists to come to South Africa. They're bringing huge amount of revenues. This is what we call easy money. You don't have to do anything. They're sitting, many of them come with $25,000 or even more. They pump it in the country, no problem, largely. Yeah. So we can grow this economy, and we must grow it one way, because if we don't, those three big issues, challenges we have, will force us to keep depending on things like USAID money. And psychologically, we'll be not just dependent, but also, I wouldn't say slave, but sort of begging again and again. And South Africa must find a way to get out of this mentality. We need to reset.
Mm-hmm. We need to reset. I think that's a great place to end the conversation. There are a number of different ways of looking at all of the challenges that we have, but also understanding a little bit more about this push and pull of power and money. Yes. And I think the best way that you've summed up for me is really understanding how South Africa and South Africans truly are addicted to this aid.
Imali.
Partly we are addicted to it because we have had a collapsing government. I mean, what those 280 NGOs and public benefit organizations do is they fill the gap between the space that government is not delivering where it should be delivering. And then you have to have a conversation about a broke government and how.
Yes. And another thing that really is filling that gap is faith-based groups. And that's something you should have somebody to talk about it when you get a chance. They fill the void so much so that believers don't just count on the state anymore, but to just go to church for hope. Where do we get our hopes? But from, God. Which we think is okay, but it's not enough. Because if God is not responding, who else should we go to?
And who does he respond to?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for your time and thank you for coming out.
Thanks very much.
It was magnificent. Wonderful.
Thank you.